Thank you so much. This is such an honor, and it's you know, the group of awardees is you know, makes me think that I'm an outlier, but you know, I'm happy to be here. And what I'm going to do is share with you some current work that actually has been inspired by psychiatric epidemiology, and it's work that we're just finishing up, and this comes at a good time to tell you about it. So I'm going to talk to you about this phenomenon that many of us have noticed, that if you do longitudinal work, oh, I'm sorry, I'm supposed to say this. So I have no financial relationships to report. We were told to do this, and nothing in the last, you know, I haven't made any money on this, and I don't plan to make any. So a lot of times when we're interested in process and when we're interested in theory, we tell people to collect repeated measures. And, of course, developmentalists are interested in that. But when you do that, a lot of times you notice that the reports of mood or health or other kinds of problems decline over time. And it's often really puzzling. The first time I noticed this, and maybe some of you have noticed it before, there is a little hint of this in the literature, but the epidemiologic catchment area, this program, this classic epidemiologic study built on a diagnostic interview that went through extensive psychometric testing. Now, our mentor, Bruce Dornman, never really liked it, but it was systematic, and the design of that study was to do a prevalence study in five different sites, and then a year later, go back and do it again. So the idea was, for the first time, they'd actually be able to look at what the incidence of disorders, because there would be a baseline. But it turned out that the lifetime reports that were obtained at the second time were lower than the first time. And Bill Eaton's written about this. Lee Robbins, who I'm going to review a little bit, wrote about it. But a lot of that second wave was never even analyzed because people just didn't quite know what to do with that. Here's another example. This is another friend and colleague who is at Columbia. He's now returned to his home in Puerto Rico. Hector Bird reported on antisocial development. So this developmental study, he recruited children who were 5 to 13. He followed, he and Gloria Sacanino followed them for 3 years. So I'm going to be talking about antisocial behavior. Well, in this age range, you expect kids to start lying a little bit, maybe having a cigarette, you know, doing a little experimentation. And so cross-sectionally, that pattern was found. So the kids who were 10 did a little bit less than the kids who were 11 who did a little bit less than 12. And these were random probabilistic samples of kids in Puerto Rico and in the South Bronx. But longitudinally, the rates went down. So here's a picture from the Bird et al. Paper, and you can see, I meant to bring a pointer, but this is a small enough room. You can see that at the younger kids, they're starting somewhere between 1 and 4. The older kids are starting somewhere between 1.3 and 1.6. So that part is the cross-sectional part, and it's reasonable. But in all the groups, males and females, in both sites, they go down, and the longitudinal effects seem to be lower than the cross-sectional part. Well, this isn't consistent with clinical or phenomenological explanation, so this is a puzzle. Now, it's been called the attenuation effect, and the implication is that those later time points are somehow attenuated, somehow they're shrunken. And Lee Robbins wrote about this in an opinion piece in Archives of General Psychiatry. And she tried to explain why they might be going down. And so she said, well, maybe the respondents think that they don't really have to tell you about what's going on later because they've already told you. You know, so there's some kind of confusion about what the task is. But in that DIS, there was also a penalty for admitting a symptom. If you admitted a symptom, then there was a lot of follow-up. And so they thought, well, perhaps people just learned that they'll have a shorter interview. These were notions that the later time points were going to be artifacts. Probably more common in the literature is the tendency for people to recruit patients. Say if you're doing you're trying to get some group that's exposed, you can go to clinics. Well, the people go to clinics when they are in a crisis. And so when you follow those folks up, they literally might be getting better. And this has been called, it's a classic kind of regression to the mean. You choose them in this clinic, but actually what you're doing is choosing them when they're at their worst, and indeed they'll get better. Well, I want to talk about some processes and some data where these kinds of explanations don't work. And so I'm going to be talking about reports of anxious mood, things that are very transient. They don't really depend, and there's no punishment. And we're going to consider three possible mechanisms for this. Now, one of them is that first time that you talk actually is therapeutic. So a lot of people who we survey don't have anybody that asks them about their mental health. And once they start doing that, that might begin to get things thinking. Another is that the survey itself is a kind of learning process where people begin to see what the language is, they see what the comparison of some of these items. And then the third one, which is an interesting possibility, is conversation norms, that participants try to fill in the blanks, to try to figure out what it is that you're asking about. So the disclosures therapy, if you've not really thought about this, it's actually in the literature. And again, one of our friends from Columbia, Richard Neugebauer, had a study of women who had been recruited following a miscarriage. And the design for this was a longitudinal study, was to interview the women at 2 weeks post-miscarriage and then wait and interview them again at 6 weeks and wait and interview them again at 24 weeks. So the notion was to watch them as they recover from this event. Now, it turned out some women couldn't be interviewed at 2 weeks, and so the decision was made instead of getting them at 3 weeks or 4 weeks to wait and get them at 6 weeks. Turns out some other women weren't able to be interviewed at either time, so they ended up being interviewed for the first time at 24 weeks. Now, this wasn't randomized, but there were no systematic differences between the women when they started. Well, here's an indication of the results. So I'm showing you results for the women who were interviewed at 2 weeks. And this is the group of women who were interviewed at all three time points. And you can see that they recovered by 6 weeks. They looked quite a bit better in terms of CESD. Rule of thumb that around 16 is where one starts getting concerned about them. But here are the women who were interviewed only two times, and their pattern looks very similar to the other group. And these are women who were interviewed just once, and these are women who were interviewed at 6 weeks, I mean at 2 weeks, and then at 6 weeks. So this pattern is very consistent with a rapid improvement that couldn't be interpreted as being consistent with the notion that that they're recovering from the stress of this. Here are the women who were interviewed for the first time at 6 weeks. And these women were interviewed only once. They weren't followed up. These women were interviewed two times. And these are a bit lower at going down. But this group is amazingly still distressed. And finally, I'm going to show you a point of women who were only interviewed for the first time at 26 weeks, and they're still stressed. And Richard and his colleagues, I'm one of those colleagues, said the possibility that such interviews afforded miscarried women substantial psychological benefits merits investigation. So he literally interpreted this as a possible therapeutic effect. Now, this is consistent with some of you may know the work of James Pennebaker at University of Texas. Pennebaker has people randomly assigned to groups where they write paragraphs about themselves. And then he follows them and finds out what happens. Well, it turns out they do better. Their relationships start getting better. Their health is better. This very brief intervention. And what Pennebaker theorizes is it starts a self-reflection process that actually takes off. It's not really just that point in time. But by taking time to stop and reflect, that could be therapeutic. So one question is whether or not filling out or answering questions in an interview might have something that's similar to that. Now, the response process as learning was articulated by a guy named Eric Knowles in Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. He actually showed this this pattern in a within an interview. He took anxiety questions, he had 60 of them, and he randomly ordered them, and then gave different people different sequences. So he had two orders, and they got in different sequences. Well, it turned out that these different sequences turn out to be different items, so it's not these aren't item differences. But later on in the interview, there was a tendency for them to be, and it was statistically significant, to report fewer. And he had a retest where he got the same phenomenon. And he wondered if people, when they were saying, well, I'm anxious or I'm nervous, a little bit later they might say, well, you know, I've already told them that, so maybe I won't say I'm so tense because they're kind of titrating what they're thinking of me. So the longer the scale, the fewer symptoms they felt they needed to report, that they'd had a chance to express their concern about anxiety. Now, a different perspective is Norbert Schwartz, who does survey research at the University of Michigan. And he argues that in a 1992 paper that participants have a goal to communicate with the investigators. You know, we invite people to be in the study. We might pay them something, but they have the choice to not do it. And when they decide to do it, it's their busy time, and they'd like to make it seem meaningful. So Schwartz reviews a communication theory perspective of Grice, who says that people in conversation want to be helpful. They want to provide the right amount of information. They typically, on the average, want to be truthful, and they want to be clear and direct. So a participant, when they start to participate in one of our studies, wonder, well, you know, what is this about? Why are they taking their time to ask me these questions? And if you've agreed to be in surveys, you probably have these same kind of questions. Is this going to be used by politicians? Is it going to be used? You know, what is this all about? Well, if they're health surveys, they might assume that the investigators want to know about health problems. You know, that seems reasonable. And if you're being interviewed by, you know, health departments, or you're being interviewed by people from fancy universities, you know, then they're thinking, well, they're going to want me to tell you about those problems. So they, at that point, become motivated to report stuff, which then invites them to use telescoping bias. You might ask them about the last week, but they say, well, it was 10 days ago. You know, they want to know about these problems, so I'm going to tell them. Or they might reframe the question in order to come up with some variation for you. And so from this point of view, they would end up giving you more problems. But then subsequent conversations, they have already shown to you that they are open, that they're not defensive, that they're willing to talk about those dark thoughts that they've had. So later on, they don't have to be motivated to do that. So that perspective would suggest that they won't have subsequent increases. Well, notice that this perspective calls into question not the validity of the later time points, but it's the validity of the first time point. And I want to have some discussion of that if you'd like, because lots of us collect only one time point. And if it's that first time point that is biased, we've got some problems to consider. So rather than calling this pattern attenuation effects, which imply that the later time points are somehow the thing that are not valid, we're simply going to describe it as a decline after an initial report. We don't know exactly what it is. So I'm going to call that a DARE, the decline after initial report, and we're going to look at those things. Now, we've laid out a bunch of possible theories, and the selection effects will certainly happen if you recruit people at the time of their worst problem. But there might be multiple processes, and we can explore those and see where those show up. So most of the DARE effects that have been reported so far are data that people were collecting to try to answer some substantive question. And then all of a sudden they find that they have this weird finding that kids become less antisocial as they move into adolescence. And then they have to deal with it. So what what we're going to try to do, I'm going to tell you about some studies that are designed to study this effect. So we're going to try to look how general it is, whether it works for, say, positive attributes as well as negative, and whether there are situations where they're larger or smaller. So I'm going to tell you about four studies. One of them is a daily diary study of participants preparing for the New York bar exam. And what you're going to find out is that some of the people who we recruited, we retained and asked them to report about their process in preparing at different time points. Then I'm going to tell you about something that looks more like a panel design, a bi-monthly study. Every 2 months, we ask college kids about their academic year. And we also ask their roommates to report. And they were randomly assigned to start at different waves. So we've unconfounded the first time point with the with this possible dare effect. And then we have another diary study, and this time it's like the college student analog of the bar exam study. These are going to be kids who are preparing for a pre-med exam. And then finally, I'm going to tell you about an experiment that's going to try to address some of the questions that tell us about what study might be better than the other. I mean, what explanation is better than the other. All right, so study one is the bar exam study. Niall Bolger and I have collaborated on this, and we've reported the substantive results, but this is the first time that we've reported these dare effects. So we recruited recent graduates of New York law schools, but not Columbia or NYU. We went to places like New York Law School or Brooklyn Law, so then we got people who are preparing for they're going to graduate, and then they're going to take the bar exam in July. They were all in relationships, so they'd been living together for at least 6 months, and we got them to fill out the diary for 5 weeks before the exam, and then about a week after, a little bit longer. Some subjects were asked to report for the first time about the diary on day 22, another group at day 35, which was actually the beginning of the bar exam, and another on day 44, which is after the bar exam. So I'm going to ask, how large is the initial dare effect? And I'm going to there's going to be a statistical theme here of comparing within and between effects. So we can look at a within-person analysis, and then we can look at some between-person analysis. So we can look at the effect on day 22, initially, and then day 22, day 35, and day 44. this just shows you the groups were initially randomly assigned, but then we ended up being concerned that we didn't have enough people in the daily diary, so we quit doing random assignments. So they're not technically randomly equivalent, but there's no differences in terms of their demographics. What I'm going to tell you about it, we had a lot of questions in this survey, but I'm going to tell you about anxious mood, I'm going to tell you about vigor, and I'm going to and these are based on the profile for mood states. And the prompt for this was, tell us how you're feeling right now, right at this moment. So there's no recall, no telescoping. Just take a little reading of how you're feeling. Then we also asked what somatic problems you had in the last day. And these include headaches, muscle pain, rashes, upset stomach, insomnia. I left a list of this on the desk, and Jane thought that I was feeling sick. But these are kinds of things that people think happened. And then we wanted something totally different, and so we asked how much time people were studying. Now, this was examinees only. Now, here is a depiction of the averages by day, and I'd like to just point out, here is the dare effect. So notice it goes down. This, by the way, is a weekend, this is a weekend, this is a weekend, this is a weekend. So there's hints that there's something going on that's reasonable in these data, that it's not just all garbage after you've done the first. You can see that people start getting pretty anxious. This is when the bar exam happens, and then they're not anxious. So that's the general framework. We're going to compare day 1 to day 8, same day of the week. It's a Tuesday. And if anything, they, as the exam is getting closer, they should be feeling more anxious. So this is a conservative test. I'm going to show you then this between group comparison. This is the group that had been doing the diary being compared to a group that was asked for their very first time on day 22. something similar on the day of the exam, and then something similar after the exam. Most of the folks after the exam are in the mountains or at the beach. The bar exam is not a pleasant thing to study for, and so that'll be interesting. So here is the initial DARE exam, and I'm going to take my time on this one, and we're going to see lots of other pictures like this. So this is comparing day one to day eight with in-person. And negative values mean more DARE. That means that the second time is lower than the first time. And what we've done in these analyses, I've standardized the outcomes, divided them by a within-person standard deviation, pooled standard deviation. So you can interpret these as effect sizes. It's like a D effect size, and 0.5 is a moderate effect size, 0.2 is a small, 0.8 is what Cohen called a large effect size. And so this allows me to show you multivariate results on a common metric. So what we find when we compare the first day to day 8 is there's a significant DARE effect for AM anxiety. I didn't tell you that the diary, when people woke up in the morning, we asked them to quickly tell us about their mood. They didn't have to do too much else. And then later in the day, they told us about their mood again, and we also got stuff on social support and so on. So the largest DARE effect was for the morning thing. That's the first time they reported that. But there's still one for the afternoon. And then SMAD, which was done for the first time in the evening, there's a DARE effect. And these effect sizes are larger than small, but not only AM anxiety is what we would call a medium effect size. This is the between group comparison at day 22. And it's significant for AM anxiety, PM anxiety, and somatic. By the way, I didn't point out, there's nothing going on for study time. PM vigor, there's a slight hint, but it's a pretty small effect. A pretty consistent pattern between person, except that the effect sizes are much larger. So they're, remember I told you that the within-person comparison, they're getting closer to the exam, so that would be a conservative estimate. There's no such thing going on here, and so there's consistent anxiety and somatic problems. Nothing really going on for vigor or study time. So it's not just like people are responding to higher score values. Day 35 is a bit of a mixed bag. Now, notice that this is when people are really pretty upset. And so now for anxiety, there's nothing going on. But they're all anxious. And so insofar as people need to tell you about how anxious they are, they don't have to make anything up. They are, the results are posted on the internet and that kind of thing. This is not one of the happiest days of their life. But there is a somatic effect still. And interestingly, there's a trend for vigor study time. They're not studying as much when they report the first time. Now, this is one of the most interesting findings. They're at the beach. They're in the mountains. They're sitting in cafes somewhere. And yet, when you ask them the first time, now remember, they were recruited at law schools. We told them what the study was. They had informed consent. And they kept thinking, these foolish researchers, they haven't called me. Why are they going to call me? Finally, we call them. It's after the exam. And this is anxiety at bay. And they're anxious. They want to tell you they're anxious. And they've got headaches. They've got aches and pains. And we ask it just for the last day. There's no study time, no vigor. So we found DARE effects pretty consistently for somatic and anxiety effects. The between person effects were generally larger, and they were often from medium to large effect sizes. The time of the exam, the effects were somewhat different. So right at the time of the exam, we didn't seem to get those as much. And even after the exam, the DARE effects were apparent. Now, you might think this might just be because those examinees were so stressed and they wanted to tell you how miserable they were. Well, they had their partners at home, and their partners weren't taking the exam. I didn't show you the I don't have the picture, but it turns out there's nothing much going on. There's not even a linear effect. They're not getting more distressed as their partner approaches the exam. However, we had them in the same design. So if someone was chosen to talk to us the first time on day 22, their partner was also asked at that time. So here is the DARE effect for day 1 versus day 8. Looks pretty similar. There's no study time effect. Nothing much going on for vigor. Actually, there is a vigor effect. But it's small in magnitude compared to the other. AM anxiety seems to be what's driving that. Here is day 22. Pretty big effect sizes, maybe even bigger than before. These groups aren't huge. Confidence bounds on these. I put the confidence bounds in, but then it got in the way of some things. So I will just fess up that they're not as precise as you might think, but they're bound, getting fairly large. Here's day 35. Day 35 for them. A lot of times their partners has left the house to go take these exams. They're reporting anxiety, somatic problems when asked for the first time. And on day 44, they also, from their place in the beach and in the mountains, are reporting more problems. They're actually, in this case, reporting significantly less vigor. So the partner summary, we got pretty similar effects. So it doesn't look like it is just the focusing on the exam. And it seems to be focused more on anxious mood and somatic problems. The effects for vigor were not so consistent. They seem to come and go. Now, we did check the DARE effects at different points in time. They varied a little bit. The within and between point I've made, and I've told you about the effect sizes. Right, so let's keep these results in mind. Study 2 has a different design. So we want to see, is there something just about the daily diary that goes on? So in Study 2, we recruited college kids when they came on campus, and we told them, we put stuff in the dorms, sign-up sheets, and we got a lot of college kids to start up. These were both at Columbia and at NYU. And we also, once someone signed up, we tried to get them to recruit one of their roommates. And so about two-thirds of the kids got the roommates in. We randomly assigned them to report this the first time in October or December or February, and everybody reported in April. The ages were the same. These were randomly equivalent. By the way, the response rate was actually pretty good. I'm going to report on the same kinds of things. We have anxious mood and vigor, and that's for current mood. Somatic problems, which are actually for the last 6 weeks. And because I asked people to report on their roommate with the K-10, I'm going to tell you about K-10. So that's like anxiety, but it's a screening scale. Ron Kessler, who got this award, invented it and named it K. I wonder why. So it has a six-week time frame also. Now, in this case, I don't have as many time points. I don't have exactly comparable things. So the within group part gets a little complicated. So what we did is we built a model, a random effects model, that has random effects for an intercept. We have an indicator of whether this was the first time that we reported this and it would have been in one of those two time points. We adjusted the time. We found that towards the end of the semester, kids were more anxious than the beginning of the semester, so we adjusted for that. So here are the effects. The sample size is quite large, and so these are significant, but it turns out the effect sizes you'll see are quite small. So we're getting palms anxious, that's immediate, vigor, immediate, somatic, which is over 6 weeks. Own K-10 over 6 weeks, and roommate's K-10. All significant, small, but consistent. So it's something that's kind of interesting. This is mostly between. There's no reason for us to think that these are biased the way we did before. The effects are quite a bit smaller for this two-month spaced interviews, but they're still there. And interestingly, the effect for the roommate is going to be informative about the therapeutic idea. There's no good reason that I can come up with why my roommate would benefit from my reporting on his health. The largest effect was for K10. That turned out to be the first thing that was in the interview. And so it's a possibility that it had a primacy effect. We did check to see if people were asked to report on themselves or asked to report on the roommates first, and that was randomly checked. We checked to see if there was a tendency to have a larger DARE effect if they reported first, and there was no such effect. So it seemed that the experience, we kind of thought that having the experience of talking about this would make them report less the second time. There was also no effect that the DARE effect seemed to be different according to whether or not their first time was in October, December, or February. Now, this panel study was described when we went to the students as a study of college life. And we asked also about alcohol and drugs. And so it wasn't about stress, and we didn't tell them it was about stress, even though we asked that. So one possibility of why these were small is maybe they weren't focused as much on that. So study three, we're going to go back to a college. Well, it also could be that the college students have the effect that are smaller. So study three, we go back to the college student population. We recruit kids from exams that are in the pre-med curriculum, and we have a two-week diary, and we ask, at this point, we get to start them on multiple days that are before the exam. So here they are, 228 students. The students had 2 weeks. It was called the exam preparation study. They knew we'd come to them and recruited from these exams at both NYU, and this is mostly NYU, but we had some Columbia kids. They're mostly female. Interestingly, these are hard science. They were mostly chemistry classes. The largest group were Asian kids. So same measures, except I didn't have K10, so we had anxious mood. They did it both when they first awakened and then later, vigor, somatic problems, hours spent studying. So in this analysis, because we have 2 weeks of data, we were able to model what's going on with them to get random effects, and so we were able to estimate both a within-person effect and a between-person effect. And so I'm going to show you these two things. First of all, here's a little graphic for those of you who like graphics. Here's the morning, here's the afternoon. Morning, here's the afternoon. Morning, afternoon. I think they're going to be DARE effects. So those are the different groups, and you can see after the exam, even though they have other exams, they're reporting much lower level of anxious mood. Somatic problems is a little flatter, but you still see those first time points sticking out. So here are the within-person DARE effects. They're not quite as large as some of the ones that we saw before, but they are a whole range of things, including study time and including vigor. So they're reporting more of those things early. Here's between group, and the effect sizes, it's the same pattern of statistical significance. Effect sizes are much larger, consistent with some of our other findings. So there are a couple of new things. First of all, we're getting these effects. They're larger, again, for between than within. But we're also getting here the effects for positive moods and for study time. Now, when you take these three studies together and we come back to the theoretical explanations, it seems like the therapeutic effects aren't going to do such a great job of explaining these findings. The learning effects are mixed, and I'll talk about those. The conversation norm, we thought, were consistent with these findings. So the therapeutic explanation The therapeutic explanation really doesn't make a prediction about time-varying effects, which we found for study one. It certainly doesn't, it's not consistent with this notion that you're going to get better if your roommate reports on your mental health. The association in study three, as we got closer, I actually skipped over that, but there was an effect that I didn't show you that we modeled the size of the effect varying as it got closer to the exam, and that was significant, tending to get larger as you got closer. So the therapeutic effect doesn't really predict that it's going to vary over time. But it is consistent with the notion that it's going to be more for the negative kinds of things than for positive. Learning effects wouldn't be predicting time-varying effects as in study one. And we also thought that it was inconsistent with the notion that if you talked about your roommate first, that you wouldn't have learned something about those questions. The time-varying results in study three, all those seem to be not quite consistent with the learning explanation. But they were consistent with weaker effects for study two relative to one and three. Study two is 2 months apart. That learning might not carry over as much. They would be consistent with both positive and negative effects. The conversation norm explanation we thought was pretty consistent with all of these things. It's varying depending on what the participant thinks the study's about and depending on the time point in the stress context. We thought it might be consistent. I'm going to move on. We designed study four to try to look at this conversation norm study explanation more carefully. And study four was a lot like study three in that it was a diary study around pre-med exam, science exam. But we used mild deception. So people signed up for the study, and we had people recruit at outside of these science classes. And then they agreed to do it. We did pre-screening to make sure that they knew what they were doing. And then on the day that the exam, the diary was supposed to start, and everybody started on the same day, they were randomly assigned one of two groups. And one group said, here's the link, go and fill out your survey. And the other group said, you know, I know you volunteered for this, but it turns out the study's filled. We don't need any more people. And this may be a disappointment. We talked to a colleague who has a similar study. It has to do with health. If you'd like to participate in his study, click on this. Well, they clicked on that link. They went to a different web page. Ted Koons, who's a colleague, is on a different floor. His nice picture was there, and he explained his study he's interested in headaches, and he has a study of headaches and somatic problems. And if they agreed to do it, then they were going to get paid the same, which was going to be $10 for filling out the diaries. They did that and his study was a one-week study, supposedly, and on the day it was over, we recontacted them, different research assistant, and said, by the way, we need our studies open again. Would you like to join? And it turned out a bunch of people were willing to do that. So the study started 10 days before the exam, and I just told you about that design. So what we predicted was that when they got an opportunity to talk about this chemistry exam, that if the conversation norm effect was what was driving this, that there would be a bump up. Because the previous study was just about headaches and things like that, and so it seemed to be irrelevant to the fact that they were taking this terrible exam. We had 119 recruits. 53 were assigned to the exam prep study. We actually oversampled. They agreed to do the second week. So what did we find? Well, first of all, the groups are, it's the assignment. Second only is not randomly assigned, but you can see that they're pretty similar.
Well, here's the finding. This is the day when they start the new exam. This is the 2-week study group, and they can have, this is the weekend when they start getting accepted. But this other one is the 2 1-week studies. So they finished their health study. This is the day they began their exam prep study, and there's no hint. However, the folks who declined to be in that first study, who signed up, they showed the effect that we've been showing over and over again.
So here are, that was for anxiety, anxious mood. Somatic, we get pretty much the same kind of findings. A vigor, there's nothing going on. So going back to my standard way of presenting this, if we wanted to just compare day one to day eight, these are the people who did one study. There's a big somatic effect. Anxious is going in that direction. The people who were in the two-group study, since there wasn't much going on, we compared them. Their findings were kind of similar. There was a little bit of a bigger going on. So if anything, if there's any error going on in these groups, it's in the first couple of days. Here's the test of the conversation norm, and we didn't get anything. And then if we compare that non-selector group 3, we're getting patterns very similar to what we found before. So darn it. Wizard, I'm not a wizard. If I was a wizard, I would have gotten findings on that last study that would have nailed down the conversation norm. But the data tell me probably not. We went in and looked at the to see how many people thought that the first study was a different investigator. 80% thought it was probably a different investigator. But they all reported, but it was remarkably similar. It seemed to be the same questions. We formatted and stuff to make it seem different, but they all noticed that it was really pretty much the same. So whatever it is that we did, they might have thought it was a new study, but they were very used to reporting these, and they did not report any excess. So didn't support that conversation norm process. However, it was consistent with some of the other findings of it, within and between. I think I'm going to skip to the overall. So what we found is that this is a pretty pervasive effect. It isn't always as large, so the 2-month effects were quite a bit smaller. In diary studies, it was quite large. It seemed to be largest in the studies where we had a story about why they were in the study. When you look at the, I think I've shown you enough data that you can see that those subsequent time points don't look like they're artifacts. So we're thinking that that first time point is something that needs that we need to be thinking about carefully. Conversation norm didn't pan out for study 4, but we gave them so much experience with that, perhaps we undercut that test. Probably different of these processes are working, but the conversation norm we think is still viable for the first time point. Now, what I'd like to do is for us to spend just one moment thinking about the implications of this. If you go to do a survey asking about Ebola, and you say, we're just interested in public reaction to Ebola. I wish I had that horn or that noise that we had. You know, bah! You know, this is very consistent with you inviting the participants to be expressive to you. Now, notice, lots of times people talk about reactivity to an exam, that you take the exam, somehow that changes you. But we're not talking about surveys of stones. We're talking about humans who are already anticipating what the question is. And that's, I think, one of the main take-home questions. As soon as you are setting this up and starting to communicate with your respondents, you are already changing their expectations. So I think this is possibly one of the most important and interesting effects. The magnitude of these effects are going to vary, we think, depending on how the stressful context, what is the story. It seems that the within-person effects are going to be somewhat smaller. That's good for longitudinal studies, but absolutely they could be larger. We tended not to see these effects for hours spent studying. However, we did find them in one case, so there was no safe haven here from many of these effects. But it does seem like the more behavioral kinds of things end up being a little more resistant. Now, one of the things that we're going to be interested in doing is seeing if are the people who are susceptible to DARE effects on some of these variables also more susceptible for the others. That's, you know, would allow us to try to see if we can kind of isolate this problem. We also have questions on alcohol and substance use. That's going to be the next analysis that we'd be doing. If this were at an alcohol conference, that's the set of results that I would have worked up. We have those, and they're about ready to be reported as well. We also have some cortisol measures in Study 3. So are there effects, or is the context of asking questions possibly related to this? And then I think the most interesting practical question is, what are the manipulations that might reduce the DARE effects? Now, my Study 4, I wish that I'd been able to show you a conversation norm effect, but I didn't. On the other hand, maybe we can learn some way to diffuse, if it is the first time point that's a little problematic, maybe giving some people some experience and asking a few questions and then coming back the next day might have allowed them to show that they're disclosing and reduce those. So those are some ideas for future directions. This is the team. These four studies had a bunch of different teams. A bunch of people have graduated and gone on to good places. My main collaborator is Niall Bolger, and this is his group up at Columbia. At NYU, we have Joy Hsu, who helped with the last studies in the couple lab. And then the other folks have taken jobs and gone away, and we're still in touch. And then I need to thank the Rima Lapous Award Committee. I'm really touched to be on this list. And to Jane and Annalisa for coming here and being wonderful supporters. And then I have the mentors, Joe Fleiss, who's deceased, Ruben Susser, who's deceased, Barbara Darwin, who's deceased. But these are really important people in my life, people that I value. And then the rest of the people are people that I have published with, and I've learned so much from them in public health and epidemiology. And I count them as my friends as well as collaborators, so thank them as well. So we've got a lot of data that I didn't tell you about because I wanted to fit. But if you have any questions or suggestions, I'd really appreciate it because I consider this to be like a real problem, not just a show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think the important question is, if you went back and reassessed those participants and compared them to some people that you hadn't had a chance to interview, would they be genuinely better? I mean, we would predict that they would report fewer problems. Would they be genuinely better as, say, checked by other kind of behavior problems? I obviously can't say that they wouldn't be, but I think these experiences can be very helpful. How therapeutic they are, I think, is still an open question. But I think asking people what they thought of the exam in debriefing is probably another thing to do. But I think my take-home message, I wish I could give you a take-home message on how to put a few questions in, make this go away. My take-home message is really think about this before you start going into the field. Start thinking about the expectations. Be aware of these effects. And when we write this up, we'll try to be a little bit more concrete about what those, but things that you could do to make things worse. But I think your point is well taken, that a subjective appraisal about whether or not this was really a special kind of event might be something that would hint on whether or not it was therapeutic. We're finding for the more subjective questions where people talk about the problems associated with drinking, we get these effects. They're smaller than this. On frequencies and counts, the more behavioral kinds of things, we're not finding effects. So, it is. So we have to get this out first to say, in contrast to the subjective things, yeah. But in general, the effects are smaller, and they seem to be in those items that have to do with evaluations of problems. Ron Kessler has done that kind of thing where he's done an immediate reconciliation. And lots of times they do back off the first report. I'll have to see if I can get something more systematic, but I've heard him talk about this in conferences. But that's precisely what he does. Now, what their motives are to help is something. You worry about asking too much of this ahead of time, and then if you ask about it retrospectively, they're going to make meaning out of it. So I think asking them immediately at the second time is probably a good thing. But what we're seeing here is not just the fact of, you say, lifetime problems. Literally, their mood is reduced the second time when it's closer to the exam. So it's it isn't a matter of something that they have to be consistent about. You know, I think that's what's interesting, that it ends up being. So I mean, you know, that kind of strips away all of those problems that Lee Robbins wrote about. That's certainly what I would do. So what do we do with our own diary data? We throw away the first 2 days because we have come to believe that those are not the most valid days. And if you have, if you have the luxury to, we should say in front of funders, we set them aside, if you have the luxury to do that, you know, I think that would be the thing to do. But I think your point is well taken, that trying to plan some opportunity for people to report problems, and whether it's the education explanation or the conversation norm, if it is the therapeutic effect, then you're changing the effect. But I will argue that the pattern that we see where people get anxious before the exam doesn't look like they've been cured by being able to talk about their anxiety. Michael?
So one other question. So this is all self-administered stuff for online, and some of the earlier ACA stuff was all interviews.
Hector Bird's study that I showed you was interviewed. Well, Norbert, who was a consultant to us, we talked about this. He doesn't think it is. He thinks that people, if they're going to spend time answering questions, that most of them are really well intended. Now, MTurk, as many of you might know, gets people to get some pocket change on Amazon, and there are people who do that, probably not as carefully, but Norbert believes that people really do try to be helpful. I think that's, we could certainly test this, but, yeah, to do an experimental comparison, right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have a very small, probably not relevant question, but intention, you mentioned intention of taking the survey. Does one need to account for a decrease in intention as the exam date gets closer? In other words, oh, darn it, I have to take that survey, but I'd rather be studying for the
We try to make the diaries very brief, and we do get a couple of people who drop off on the days before the exam, but mostly once they start doing it, they get pretty good at it. That's our experience. Now, the young people, we can send them texts. We either send them email or text, depending on what they want, so we remind them, and a lot of times they just do it. Yes. I haven't analyzed those data. Yeah, I have the data. That's future directions. I have analyzed the alcohol, but I haven't written those up. But it was a kind of a check to see, and cortisol is not the answer to biological measures are interesting, but they have their own problems. So that's why I didn't make it my highest priority, but we'll definitely be looking at those soon. Thank you.
And on the conversation norm hypothesis, I wondered if you would consider like too crude to do an experiment where in one situation you tell them a little introduction, say, well, you might think that we want to hear about this, or you might think that we, you might want to report these things, or you might think that we really want you to report these things, but really, we don't care. We just want you to say what really happened.
Yeah, I think trying some interventions like that could work. There's something called I've just lost it. There's something like moral licensing, in political psychology or moral things, where if you have participants do something that they feel very honorable to, like if they're a minority person, I mean, they're a majority person, and they get a chance to choose a seat next to a minority person. And then a little bit later, you ask them to make some derogatory comment. They're more likely to make the derogatory comment if they've been able to show that they're open-minded. You know, so that's called moral licensing. And there are some systematic effects like that. Now, one guesses that the derogatory comment is more genuine, and that the, you know, that this kind of self-regulation is something else. But I think your idea is a very good one. That, you know, and I don't know exactly how to do it, but one way to do it would be to invite people to say what is the worst thing that they ever did, and kind of let them get it out and show that they're really disclosing, and then perhaps tell them, all right, now we're really interested in these other things. We know, you know, whatever you told us before. But I think we need to both figure out if that can reduce those effects, and then try to see how that can be generalized for other studies. They tend to be, you know, the biggest effects we're seeing for the kinds of things that we're interested in epidemiology, distress, and you know. So I think we have to take this seriously still. I think what Norbert Schwartz has written about contrasting, and people often will keep their responses in mind. Now, notice the two-month study, which had smaller DARE effects, it's probably impossible for them to have kept in mind exactly what they responded. So that won't explain it all, but I think a part of that contrasting is what's going on. Now, the interesting second point to that is whether or not what they're contrasting to was something that they responded to maybe with a little bit too much exuberance. And if so, then that would make the DARE effect even larger. But I think your subjective experience is very similar to what we're seeing in the data. Yeah, I think the you know, the therapeutic explanation I ended up not preferring, but I think insofar as people are kind of learning and thinking about themselves and getting used to reporting these things, there might be some kind of genuine change, but we're guessing it's small relative to the context. So what we were able to show with one of the reasons why we like these exam studies is because you know what the pattern should look like, and we get that pattern. So in that context, they're able to say, well, yesterday I was a 2 on this thing, but you know, I'm worse than yesterday. You know, so it can go both ways. I didn't sleep well. I wish that I was on top of this, and I wish it was over. and then they'll report more. But that contrasting effect is something that people study by looking at the order of items and things like that. I think it's a real process. So I think there are a lot of interesting kind of cognitive processes that are worth considering, as well as emotive. That's what we really count on. We count on them being ready to be participants with us in understanding themselves and us. Yes?
So was there any particular response to the IRP?
No, this is mild compared to what we do in social psychology. We had three people that when we told them that we had done this mild deception, we give them the option to delete their data, and three people, all in the situation where they weren't deceived, asked for their data to be removed, and we did that, which turns out to be an interesting statistical question. My assistant, a graduate student, had just deleted the person. I said, no, we have to keep them in, and we might want to do multiple imputations later, you know, to recognize, you know, that. So we had to actually keep their IDs in and then make all their data go away. But, yeah, so there were the three people who found it annoying. But this is actually quite minor compared to what people do in my department. Yes. We were interested in using that report of studying just as another completely different kind of measure. So I wasn't really analyzing the study hours per se. We did, however, the professors who helped us recruit the subjects wanted to know how studying was related to their exam day. We asked the students after the exam what grade they got on the exam. Turns out, and this is Columbia and NYU, the students are pretty talented, but there were some students who only started really studying a couple of days before the exam, and they were getting C's and D's, F's. There were other students who studied 5 or 6 hours a day consistently on the weekends. The exam took place, and you saw how things dropped down. No matter, they were out there studying again, dropping down to, you know, maybe four or five hours of study. They were the straight A students. So, yeah, there is variation, and it was meaningful, and it was related to performance on the exams in ways that one might guess. But, you know, what we're interested in is the quality of those data. And it looked like mostly they weren't a problem, although we did get a DARE effect on the first day in the third study. But it's, we can study a lot of these things with random effects, when you substantiate. We actually have quite a bit of data that we should look at other things for, but I was just trying to focus on this effect. All right, well, thank you all for the questions and for coming.
Excellent.
Thank you.